You know, one of the things that we read about and hear polling results on is about the media and people's distrust of the media. In fact, there was one in-house survey done by the federal government that found that basically only about 30%, 33% of Canadians trust the media. And I want to be careful myself about broad generalizations, because then I remember the work of people like Terry Glavin, who've brought numerous stories to our attention, important stories that prove to be pivotal. And that's why I always want to remind people, there are some excellent people doing excellent work. That's why I'm pleased to bring one of them on with me right now, Terry Glavin, who's a leader in so many different areas, by the way, in subject areas. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Winnipeg lab spying episode. Also, I'm going to get on to what's happened with Canada, anti-Semitism, that kind of thing. But Terry, first of all, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, it's always nice to talk to you, Michael. It's always nice to talk.
Well, let's start with the Winnipeg lab situation. Maybe you could give people that in a nutshell. I mean, I'm, you know, sitting back, I'm going, hey, they were spying. And I thought we knew that. I thought we knew. Now we've got validation with that 612-page report getting finally released like 3-4 years later. But right. I mean, I don't know how anyone can have confidence out of reading that.
Yeah, it actually raises so many interesting questions for me, because we have compromised our capacity as a country to understand what subversion is and espionage is and foreign interference is, that what was happening in Winnipeg with these two scientists was basically normal.
Hmm.
It had become normalized. These kinds of intimate relationships between Canadian research institutions, universities particularly, and agencies and institutions of the Chinese state were such that you could basically have a couple of people in Canada's top security microbiology and infectious diseases research institution who were violating security protocols, passing passwords around, inviting groups of foreign students to wander through the lab on the weekends and have a look at whatever they wanted. And one of them particularly was co-authoring papers with really, really dodgy characters from one of the institutions she was working with was a unit of the People's Liberation Army's microbiology division. In other words, you know, germ warfare and stuff. And the thing that is, I think, for me, that is shocking is, or the question that this raises for me is, how these people get security clearance in the first place? You know, what kind of people are we clearing? And on what basis do we grant people the highest possible clearance to the most sensitive and dangerous top secret information in Canada? And that question, we've not really got close to that question yet. The other thing to notice is that, as you say, I mean, you know, these guys were observed doing, you know, behaving in really unusual ways going back to 2018. You know, that's 6 years ago now. And they were doing some, you know, routine security reviews. The lab brought in an outside consultant to just check the boxes and said, holy cow, who are these people that you got working for you? CSIS came in and did one review, and then it seemed to be, well, this is the way we're supposed to behave these days. And then came in a year later and did another review. And basically, imagine the CSIS guy basically writing, holy crap, as he's composing this report. So I think the thing to notice for me, the thing to notice is that, you know, when this started to make its way into the news media, the thing to notice is the response from the federal government, the Trudeau Liberals. You know, there's a pattern. If you are a decent, reasonable Canadian citizen and you raise concerns about the astonishing acquisition of real estate by numbered companies in China, you'll be called a racist. And in this case too, Trudeau gets up in the House of Commons. Well, you know, this is kind of racist to ask these sorts of saucy questions about what's happening in Winnipeg. And then I went to the extraordinary lengths of, actually some interesting sort of parliamentary precedent that was set of refusing a direct order from Parliament to produce documents. And it, to the point of taking the Speaker of the House of Commons to court to prevent him from ordering Public Health Canada to appear before committees and produce documents. This had never happened before. And so there is a kind of a pattern, is that anytime the issue of Chinese influence, interference, infiltration somehow enters the public consciousness, a senator or an MP in the House of Commons will raise it. It's the same thing. The Trudeau government will barricade, will block, will obfuscate, will obstruct, will filibuster. And I think, to me, this tells its own story. You know, this goes back right through the whole Chinese, and by Chinese, believe me, I'm putting that in quotation marks, interference episodes in the 2019 and 2021 elections, which we knew about, which we could watch. The Atlantic Digital Research, Forensic Research Lab was tracking this stuff. And it was only when people within the RCMP and CSIS and even within NSICOP started leaking things, you know, basically saying, holy God, this is completely out of control. The federal liberals are not paying attention to what we're telling them. They don't seem to care. That, you know, it really got traction. And so more of, you know, obstruction, we get the special rapporteur, the David Johnston thing. That completely falls apart in absolute disgrace and catastrophe. I mean, you know, you appoint not only a lifelong family friend, a Trudeau Foundation guy, but also one of China's highest profile friends in Canada to look into this. And then you get, you know, the majority of the House of Commons, we need a public inquiry, we need a public inquiry. And that's the stage we're at now. And we've already been given reason to believe that this inquiry is not going to do what we expected it to do. We've had the Canadian Friends of Hong Kong and the Uyghur Rights Action Project pulling out of it, saying this is wrong. We've given Yen Pao-Wu, a senator who is, for all intents and purposes, the Chinese embassy's man in the Senate, and Han Dong and Michael Chan, the liberal kingmaker, who they make no apologies and don't hide their affinities with the Chinese Office of Overseas Affairs, with the United Front Work initiatives, you know, their influence peddling and strong arm units, bigger, by the way, than the entire Chinese Foreign Ministry. They're a big deal, and you know, so you got Han Dong and Michael Chong that have been given standing, and also Yen Pao-Wu, and that's where this thing is going. And it actually does relate to what you and I were discussing earlier about this strange eruption, these really blood-curdling eruptions of anti-Semitism in the streets, cloaked in the guise of support for the horribly suffering people of Gaza. Well, I'm not quite sure why we don't think of all that as a foreign interference operation too, but there you go.
Let me come back to just a couple of things, because the attitude of the government clearly hasn't changed. I mean, wasn't it just last week you found the Liberal and the New Democrat MPs voting to block an ethics committee probe of why, you know, that cabinet concealed that report, you know, into the Chinese security breaches? I mean, there's been no cooperation on this file, and there's so many other examples I know, but this just happened to show up last week. And as I say, you know what it reminds me of? There's so many different areas, and sorry, I'm digressing for a sec, but I'm looking at CISA saying that, you know, they ignored every possible security protocol to pull this off. well, we just talked with the Auditor General about what happened with ArriveCan. And that was exactly what she said. They ignored every stated protocol of how you manage projects. You know, everywhere I look, it's this, but the efforts to block public scrutiny just can't be overlooked. You know, and that's why I don't have any faith in the so-called independent inquiry. First of all, it's taken 100 years. They're hoping I'll die and stop criticizing them, you know, before that comes true. But I'm interested to hear that you share that view, is that it's hard to have any faith that we're going to have an independent inquiry into Chinese interference.
Yeah, that's basically the gist of my piece in the National Post today. That, you know, the pattern is just so repetitive that it's almost boring now. You can just set your watch by it, that, you know, there'll be some horrible revelation that makes its way into the public debates about Chinese interference or influence or infiltration, and the government will appear to make all the right noises and then will filibuster, obstruct, block, barricade. And that's what they've done in the latest move against the Ethics Committee. There wouldn't have even been a standing committee on Canada-China affairs if the Liberals had not found themselves in a minority position in Parliament 3 years ago. You know, they fought that. They said, no, you know, the Foreign Affairs Committee, that's where we deal with these things. In the case of the Ethics Committee, no, that's, you know, it's not to be dealt with at the Ethics Committee. It's not the right place for it. And then they pack committees like the House Affairs Committee, which was looking into these things fairly effectively for a while. And they, you know, I think the question has to be raised. Why is the government trying to hide this? What is the government trying to hide? Why does it insist that this strangely opaque relationship that the Trudeau government, the Trudeau Liberals, the Trudeau family has maintained with through conduits like the Canada-China Business Council, the Power Corporation, the Trudeau Foundation, this strange opaque relationship with China, with the, you know, ruling elites of China and the corporate elites of China? Why aren't we allowed to look at it? Why aren't we allowed to even notice it? You know, you say something out loud about it, and the next thing you know, people are calling you a racist. And it's pretty funny, because most of the people who have been raising these issues happen to have what I like to call not suspiciously waspish-sounding names. You know, they're Asians. They're Cantonese. They're Mandarin speakers as well. They're Uyghurs. They're Falun Gong practitioners. They're Chinese Democrats. You want to call them racist? Okay.
Well, and that, of course, that's the trick to shut down any conversation. We started that, by the way, if you recall, it was, I think, off the top of my head, February 4th, 2020, and talking about the possible origin of COVID from the Wuhan lab. Immediate response from Prime Minister Trudeau and Theresa Tom, Canada's health minister, was that's a racist accusation. Well, there's a lot of information that's come out since then about that potential, but I don't want to get waylaid there because I want to get into something else.
Yeah, there's potential for that lab theory. I actually did dismiss it fairly out of hand at the outset. I had my own little pet theories. Mm-hmm. But I think it's not some weirdo conspiracy theory. There's reason to think that the Wuhan lab may have been involved.
Let's move on to the situation in Canada. You mentioned anti-Semitism, which, you know, anybody listening to this show knows I've been blown away by the degree. And remember, it erupted before there was any, you can't hide behind Israel's response in Gaza for that, because it was evident October 8th. You know, we had protests. We saw it in the States, and I know that's not necessarily, you know, part and parcel with Canada, but we saw it on university campuses. We saw it in public sector unions instantly, though, like before any retaliation had taken place. And I, for one, never saw that coming. I was completely blown away. And you've done some absolutely excellent work that people have to go to the National Post, go and read Terry on, and I highly recommend you subscribe to The Real Story on Substack. And by the way, we're going to give away a couple of free memberships to Substack, and I'll tell you about that in a second, to Terry Substack, The Real Story, literally alone in that, in digging deeper into the Selena Robinson firing by the BC cabinet, the only Jewish member, that I just think is a must read to understand what's going on. But let me just start with your broader take on, were you shocked at the anti-Semitism that we saw in public display, in public institutions, in other places at that degree? That's, you know, I mean, there's just no denying it was a huge degree across the country.
Well, it takes a lot to surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had been paying attention to this quite closely for so many years, I was actually surprised. I think I should say quite happily surprised by how shocked and surprised and disgusted so many ordinary Canadians were when they were looking at this stuff. And as you say, you know, all kinds of very, very serious and passionate criticisms can be raised in respect of the prosecution of the war in Gaza and criticisms of the Israeli government. My God, that's what Israelis do all the time. But what we saw erupt in the most blood-curdling way in Canada, the most outrageous and revolting fashion, this was happening before the blood had even dried on the ground.
Yeah.
In Kfar Azah and in the Gaza envelope and in all those other communities. I mean, I was there. I was actually there about 3 weeks ago, in the south particularly, and, you know, around in the kibbutzim. And I don't need to belabor the point, I think. It was just horrible and unspeakably sad. And this is the way we threw our arms around the innocent people of southern Israel. We went out into the streets with our placards and we started protesting at Jewish delicatessens and synagogues with Free, Free Palestine placards. Way to go.
Well,
and I think this actually is related to, you know, the incoherence that we're seeing on the subject of Chinese interference in Canada. In this way, how do you articulate national security? How do you talk about national security in a post-national state? You know, the Trudeau liberals have been, you know, the sort of borderless post-national idea.
Yep.
Of Canada, and the great advantage that we had was the Trudeau family's, you know, multi-generational relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. We got Jean Chrétien and all of these, you know, liberal gargoyles with intimate relationships with, you know, all of these state-owned enterprises, CNOC, the Chinese Investment Corporation. And we're going to, this is how we're going to build a new Canada. You know, we're going to have 100 million people living here by, what is it, 2070? I forget what the proposal is. The whole thing will be designed by Dominic Barton, you know, from the disgraced McKinsey empire, who, you know, spent half his working life, you know, greasing palms in China before he was appointed the head of Trudeau's Economic Growth Council. And then, you know, when John McCallum becomes such an embarrassment by taking China's side in the Meng Wanzhou to Michaels affair that Chrystia Freeland had to say, well, look, either he goes or I go. And so we go months without an ambassador and we get this this Dominic Barton character as our ambassador. If you don't have a sense of a core Canadian identity, if you don't have a civic nationalism with some fire in the belly that is devoted to die on this damn hill of liberal democracy, of the sanctity of our alliances with our NATO partners, the rule of law, if you don't have that, that you're going to be in a difficult spot. And if you have a government that is consciously hostile to that conception of Canada, you're going to end up with spies in the Winnipeg lab. I mean, what kind of argument can you raise against it? Well, yeah, okay, well, maybe they were doing some business on the side. Maybe they had a little bit of a side hustle, selling intellectual property to our friends in Beijing or Shanghai or Shenzhen. Yeah. And similarly, I think, too, it is a generational thing. I mean, I come by my anti-fascism, I come by it honestly. And it's a family thing. And we have some family relationships that make... I'm an Irish Catholic, and a lot of people have imagined that I'm Jewish, but I'm Irish Catholic. It's complicated. And we have family that have, you know, the Nazis, we fought the Nazis. And I think, you know, a lot of people have forgotten that there are reasons why anti-Semitism is a particularly and noticeably and historically toxic and corrosive phenomenon. And it takes all kinds of forms. My reluctant conclusion is that it is ineradicable, that it requires constant vigilance. But this is like, you talk like this to, you know, to a lot of people who have come out of the, you know, Metropolitan University of Toronto, whatever it's called now, the UBC Critical Studies, yada, yada. And they just think you're some, you know, like, what the hell are you talking about? It's just a different kind of language. And I think, you know, a lot of Canadians are shocked. A lot of normal Canadians have been absolutely shocked by what they've been witnessing on all of these fronts. You know, the way we normalized China, you know, relationships with the People's Republic of China, the way we've normalized the proposition that it is not beyond the pale, it is within the realm of public debate to contemplate the annihilation of the state of Israel, the fruits of the Jewish national liberation movement can be sundered and the Jews can be driven into the sea. And this is, well, this is an interesting opinion.
Yeah.
You know, we'll go to you, you know, what do you think of this? It's like, no, at some point you just got to say, you know, those are fighting words.
What worries me is that, yeah, I wonder what that line is for many people. But just to add to what you're saying, because your work has done great work in this, the level of infiltration is shocking of the Chinese Communist Party of Canada. You mentioned the United Workers' Front Department. I mean, my God, we know that's the Communist Party of China. It's not like it's, oh, that's a shock. They're operating freely in our country. They were operating freely, these secret police stations. That's on one level. Let's go to the, as you say, the relationship. I think it's the degree to which the anti-Semitism is in our political parties. I mean, clearly in the NDP, clearly in the Liberal Party of Canada, that it's in clearly at our universities, clearly at our public sector workers. And there was no bottom line, you know, something that would have been so abhorrent to us. I don't know. You probably know a better time frame than I would. But, you know, I just don't think it was happening 15 years ago. You know, I mean, a smaller degree. It's the degree to which I think that has shocked many people, even those who were paying attention. It's the degree of it.
Yeah, my friend Ben Cohen has written a wonderful book about this. He's a Londoner. I love Ben. It's called Some of My Best Friends, ... And he makes a distinction between what he calls beer keller anti-Semitism and bistro anti-Semitism. You know, we're used to the sort of beer keller anti-Semitism. You know, it's usually, you know, really awful, nasty people. Some of them are at the extreme fringes of the of various conservative parties, you know, skinheads, whatever. We can see it. We can recognize it. You know, it's easily recognizable. What's far more insidious and what people haven't been paying attention to is what Ben calls bistro anti-Semitism. And it's the anti-Semitism of the radical chic, of the avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And it is very much a thing, and it is perhaps even more destructive because it's a function like, you know, fascism and Nazism used to be a function of what, back when we were Marxists, we would call the petty bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. But bistro anti-Semitism is really a function of the elites and elite, you know, university graduates, yeah, and people who run art galleries, and it's not the kind of thing that that a lot of, shall I say, Gentiles are used to, and it's extremely toxic and extremely corrosive. So yeah, I think we're at a very interesting inflection moment in Western history and in Canadian history. And I think we really do need to, you know, I actually do have some opinions about this. I don't just make, you know, write backgrounders and analyses. This for me is, this is the line you don't goddamn well cross. You know, I mean, like, I've got a mezuzah hanging from my door. You know, nobody, when push comes to shove, I'm sorry, it's just a line you can't cross. And I think a lot of people in the NDP, a lot of people cross it without knowing it even, you know, it's sort of like the illiterate, left. A lot of people go to these demonstrations because they're upset and they don't know anybody, you know, and that's what Canadians do. You know, you're mad about something you've seen on the TV, you know, you got some friends and then we're going to go to a demonstration and stop the war. Okay. I mean, bless their hearts, right? But I'm afraid most of these demonstrations, actually, most of them have been organized by, on the West Coast, you know, you've got Samadoun, which is the overseas fundraising and recruitment arm of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a Palestinian terrorist group best known for airline hijackings and suicide bombings and that kind of thing. And you've got the Palestine Youth Movement, which was handing out sweets by the evening of October 7th, Michael, rejoicing in this stuff. And it's here. It's here. It's among us now. And unless we develop, as I say, some kind of liberal democratic fire in the belly, in the way of a civic nationalism that can guard against these toxicities, these pathogens, these sociopathologies, then we're in trouble. We're in big trouble. And a lot of it's, you know, it comes down to, you know, a significant sort of identifying factor. And it infects journalism. You know, if there's no such thing as truth, if the disciplines of journalism that allowed reporters to do a fairly good job of arriving at the truth, approaching the truth, if this is all sort of problematized to the point where it's your truth and it's my truth and it's somebody else's truth, then ultimately the truth that will prevail will be the truth with the deepest pockets, the loudest voices, the shiniest boots, and the sharpest knives. So, you know, we better get ready for this.
Well, I just think that's very well put. And it's again, why I just think people should go to the National Post, you know, type in Terry, you can read just about anything, but his work on these two subjects has been brilliant. But also we're going to give away, you know, some subscriptions to The Real Story. You can get it on Substack, and the extra depth that Terry gets a chance to go into on these very important subjects, though. I just am very thankful for that level of industriousness and intellectual rigor that Terry presents on a absolutely regular basis.
That's really kind of you.
Well, it's absolutely true. And I think people listening to this show know I call it as I see it, and that's how I see it. Terry, thank you for finding time for us. As always, it's so much appreciated.
As always, it's always lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Take care, Mike.